Well, we need a little bacon and we need a little bean, but we survived a hurricane way down in New Orleans.
Hello, beautiful humans. I'm Tymy Castle.
And I'm Benjamin Mead.
And you're listening to Just a Minute. Just a Minute is an educational podcast where we break down justice topics in 30 minutes or less. Today's topic, Hurricane Katrina. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Hello, Ben.
Hello, hello. Before you go into the opening information, I was just working on our spreadsheet where we keep track of our episodes.
Yes.
This is number 70 original. This is our 70th original episode.
70. We still have not beat that other podcast. The one that's defunct, that recorded over 100 episodes.
We're getting close.
We're getting close.
We're getting close. 72 released, because we re-released two. But
yes,
this 70. Is our 70th, recording our 70th original episode.
While we're at it, let's just give a shout out to our listeners in Hungary.
Oh, yeah. Hey.
Number two
Hungry
country
listeners.
Streaming. Okay, so Ben, what were you up to 20 years ago? I know you were probably just starting grad school.
Fall 2025 was my second year of my master's degree program.
You mean 2005, not 2020.
Oh, yeah, 2005. It's 2025, 20 years ago, 2005. Yeah, it was my second year of my master's program.
Yes. Gosh, we're old.
I know. And I can remember, we're going to talk about Hurricane Katrina.
Yes.
And I have very vivid memories of two historic events when I was living in my Columbia apartment. One of them is Hurricane Katrina.
Right.
I can remember seeing on the TV, the images of people on their roofs.
Right.
And then I remember the 2008 financial crash.
Yes.
I remember like wrapping presents and watching the news
Oh,
this is going to be bad. This is going to be bad.
That's right. When I started here during that. Mm. So that's a whole other, you know, we're not getting a raise. Anyway, let's just move it along, shall
Sounds
we?
Sounds good. Yep.
It's been 20 years since Hurricane Katrina made landfall on the U.S. Gulf Coast on August 29th, 2005, which was last Friday, 20 years, because we are recording on September 4th. Mm. And the tragedy that many people are familiar with is not the direct impact from the storm.
Right.
Rather, it's the catastrophic structural failure of the levees to hold back the storm surge.
Right.
There are several documentaries out right now that introduce so many intersecting justice issues. You've got climate change, environmental justice, environmental racism, state corporate crime. In fact,
I liked your cheerleader hands. They like, duh, and duh, and duh.
Yes, you can't see them. But in fact, I do not think we can do an adequate job covering all of them in such a compressed time frame. But we do cover some that, you know, some of these topics we have previously discussed in episodes, and we'll mention those.
I don't know. I have faith in you. I have every confidence
thanks.
In you. You're going to do a great job.
I'm not. I had to cut stuff out already. So 20 years ago, I was living on the Florida Gulf Coast at the time, and up until about 3 days out, it was heading straight for us. And we were preparing to evacuate, but then it turned, and the hurricane made landfall farther down the Gulf Coast over Mississippi. New Orleans avoided a direct hit. Do you recall watching any of the television footage? You said that you saw people on their roofs.
Yeah, I can very vividly remember having the TV on and being in a specific spot in my apartment and seeing the footage of the floods and people on their roofs. Yeah.
Yeah. So in terms of how we're going to organize this, I think we'll just kind of go in a linear fashion and highlight some of the major issues.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we will not be able to do justice to this topic in 30 minutes. So I encourage our listeners to watch some of those new documentaries. One is on Netflix and then there's another on Hulu.
I haven't seen them yet. Which one's which one's the better one?
They're both great. I think you have to see them both because they feature different interviewees and residents, and together they create like a full picture.
Gotcha.
So the Netflix documentary features some interviews 20 years out from the same people that Spike Lee interviewed for the 2006 documentary When the Levees Broke, which I also encourage you to watch. But it's interesting to see kind of where they're at now, what the long-term effects of the tragedy has been.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start with the hurricane itself. So New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, it's funny because every time I say New Orleans, I say it different.
I noticed that. Yep. You said New Orleans earlier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I would say New Orleans because I'm from Kentucky, but they say New Orleans. It's kind of like Nolans, smushed together.
No, definitely in the same area, New Orleans kind of guy here.
We drag it out in Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
So the Gulf Coast, no strangers to hurricanes. First and foremost, there was no excuse for the city to be as unprepared as it was.
Yeah, I mean, you think about Bourbon Street, they've got plenty of the alcohol and supplies to, you know, serve their customers, hurricanes in the bars, but
yes,
our city officials are not going to be ready for a real hurricane.
No. So 1 year prior, Hurricane Ivan hit the coast, but it actually hit where I lived before I lived there, causing widespread destruction. It didn't end up being the big one for New Orleans since it turned, but the Hurricane Center at Louisiana State University knew it was just a matter of time before there was a, quote, the big one. So they had war-gamed a simulation that year prior that predicted the levees would fail. They had failed before and submerged a lot of the city, so they knew this was going to happen again.
Yeah.
One issue, of course, is global warming, and this has made hurricanes more intense and frequent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we talked about that in our climate change episode, so go back and listen to that, people.
We need to remember what numbers these episodes are so we can give them to people as a reference, but you know, at this point we've done 70, so I don't remember.
That's right.
I don't know what the numbers are. So the coastal area around New Orleans used to have thick, dense wetlands that acted as natural hurricane defenses, mitigating storm surges from previous hurricanes. But these were diminished over the prior two decades by the activities of oil and gas companies. So in addition to global warming and climate change, you have the corporations to thank.
I didn't realize that.
Yes. I'm going to link to that article because we don't have time to go into it, but I'll link to that article in the show notes. Mm-hmm. But Congress had lifted a ban on exporting crude oil in the last decade, and the U.S. became one of the world's leading oil exporters. While at the same time, U.S. exports of gas, which were frozen to liquid form and then shipped, also started in earnest. And last year, America became the world's leader. Did you know that?
In frozen gas?
Shipping out frozen gas.
I did not know that, but way to go, America.
Yeah. We're number one. Well, it just says we're a world leader. Mm. I don't know if that's number one.
Gotcha.
So the Louisiana coast is ground zero for these plants and all of the things that come with having, you know, oil and gas plants. So these were known factors influencing the impact of hurricanes, again, caused by corporations, because the water used to wind around those cypress and oak trees in the marshy wetlands, and it drastically reduced the impact of the water by the time it hit the land and slowed it down considerably.
And those are the things that have been cleared for, like, these mining rigs and
right.
Oil refineries and things like that.
Yes, they were natural defenses, and now they're gone.
Gotcha.
So this also allowed the pump stations to keep ahead of the water coming in. But those pump stations were built in the early 1900s, and guess what? They failed during the storm. Turns out you kind of have to update equipment, especially when you've got climate change, global warming, and corporations eliminating your natural defenses. Mm-hmm. So the levees that existed but failed also during, they also failed during Hurricane Betsy. They weren't in the same form. So
gotcha.
There was Hurricane Betsy happened in 1965, and storm surges during that reached some roofs of houses and people died in their attics, which is going to be repeated in 2005.
Yeah.
So the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Hurricane Protection Program came into existence as a result of Betsy. And the Corps built new levees for New Orleans that were both taller and made of stronger material, designed specifically to resist a fast-moving Category 3 hurricane like Betsy. Mm. And guess what failed during Hurricane Katrina?
Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levees all failed.
Yes, they did. So that's the levee issue. Let's talk about mandatory evacuation orders and why it is estimated that approximately 100 to 150,000 people remained in the city.
Wow.
I always ask my students this question, and they come up with all the reasons why people might not leave if they have mandatory evacuation orders. So it's important to know that these came late, because at first it was just a voluntary evacuation. So by the time the mayor says mandatory on, you know, Saturday morning before the storms, or be out on Sunday morning. It's a little late.
Yeah.
So let's role play you as a student in my first day of research methods when we talk about disaster research. You ready?
Yeah.
What are some of the reasons why people might not heed the warning?
Professor Castle, can I answer this question?
Yes, please do.
Well, I mean, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about like snowstorms here. And obviously, there's no comparison, but it's just like you're getting ready for a snowstorm and you're kind of prepping and you maybe anticipating the worst, but hoping it's not going to happen. And so I'm just like, okay, I don't want to leave. I'm just going to, you know, stick it out and hope for the best. Maybe things could get bad, but also it'll probably be okay. So I'll just stay where I am. That could be one reason. But also, if I wanted to, I could hop in my car and leave if it got bad enough or if I wanted to ahead of time.
Yeah.
And I can imagine a lot of people in urban areas don't have cars.
Right.
Or, you know, particularly in poor neighborhoods may not have the means or access to things that they need to leave. I listened to a podcast, This is Criminal, with Phoebe Judge.
Yes.
And she did her Katrina anniversary episode on the guy who, and I had not heard this story before, but he basically stole a school bus.
Oh, Jabbar Gibson.
Yeah, and you know, loaded up the school bus with a bunch of people and drove them.
He just
to
picked
Houston.
Up people on the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And then I also think about people who were like unable to evacuate because of illness or disability or you know, lack of resources or other reasons, I guess.
Correct. Mm-hmm. New student.
Oh, thanks.
Good job.
You do not hate me.
No, I don't. Most people who were able to leave did.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the working class and poor without the means to do so who stayed behind. Most relied on public transportation. And they just ride out the hurricane like they did with Ivan, which ended up turning and not hitting them, right?
Yeah.
So local and state officials should have planned for a possible need to evacuate people. And guess what? They did, and that simulation was called Hurricane Pam, which was a plan to use city and school buses to evacuate, which Mayor Nagin did not do.
And Jabbar did instead.
Jabbar hijacked a school bus by the levee and just started picking up people on the way. Instead, he asked FEMA for help, which also is going to become a big problem. So ultimately, Katrina's storm surge caused 53 breaches. I almost said britches. Because we have said that in a previous episode.
Yeah, patch your britches.
Yep. 53 breaches to flood protection structures in and around the greater New Orleans area, submerging 80% of the city. A June 2007 report by the American Society of Civil Engineers indicated that two-thirds of the flooding was caused by the multiple failures of the city's flood walls, and a federal appeals court later did put the responsibility firmly on the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Mm-hmm. So most of the deaths were caused by the levee breach and storm surge, the water?
Correct. The Superdome, most famously, as well as the Convention Center, were both being used as shelters for those who did not evacuate or could not evacuate. But by the time the water started rising, it was difficult for many people to escape their homes and get there. So many people died from drowning and getting trapped in their houses. Rescue efforts began once the storm died down, mostly by neighbors who co-opted boats and tried to help save their neighbors. There are thousands of hours of footage from during and after Katrina. So most of what we're going to discuss here and is in the interviews is backed up by video footage at the time.
Yeah.
The Coast Guard also did not need to wait for permission from government officials to act, so they immediately began rescuing people from rooftops. Once the storm cleared and the sun came out, people who were trapped in their attics and on roofs started to cook as temperatures reached 100 degrees on one of those days.
Oh my gosh, I can't even imagine.
No, and it's like that, you know, deep south humidity.
Yeah.
Oh, and there was a storm. There's all this water. Can you imagine?
Mm-hmm.
Once no, they were,
be awful.
Yeah, it would be awful. Once they were rescued, they were taken to the Superdome, which we'll talk about in just a minute. But first responders who had access to boats also did try to save as many people as they could. But many people, who, like I said, died in their attics or they drowned in floodwaters because they couldn't swim.
Mm.
One man said the family, his whole family got on the roof, but the water rose so fast that mm-hmm. the house came loose from its foundation and just started mm-hmm. going down the street, like traveling down the street.
Yeah. I mean, and even if you can swim,
yeah,
that's not a situation you're going to yeah. be able to swim your way out of.
Exactly.
Like your house is going down the street.
Your house
like
is all floating of the debris down the street.
And stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And mm-hmm. there's loads of pictures of this yeah. in the footage. So they ended up hitting another house and it knocked off his 3-year-old granddaughter. Mm. Who they were trying to save because she managed to get onto a truck mm-hmm. when his mother got knocked into the water and both ended up dying.
Oh my gosh.
So there are lots of these firsthand accounts of experiences in these documentaries. So again, I encourage you to check those out just so you can see the footage. I mean, again, so mm-hmm. much footage. Over 700 bodies were recovered in New Orleans mm. by October 23rd. Now think about how much later that is. So there were bodies mm-hmm. that were still there.
Wow.
A month or more later. Mm. Some survivors and evacuees reported seeing dead bodies lying in city streets and floating in still flooded sections. And the media reported on this as well, taking video of floating bodies. And you can see it in yeah. these documentaries. The advanced state of decomposition of many corpses, some of which were left in the water and hot sun for days before being collected, hindered efforts by coroners to identify victims.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. So you mentioned the Superdome earlier. So what happened? I imagine it was like chaos in there. Weren't there like reports of like rapes, robberies, murders, riots, serial right. killings,
according
bombings, explosions, nuclear attacks?
According to the media, no. So this is where we introduce another justice issue, that being the role of the media. I haven't taught this course in some years, but we used to spend in my media and justice course a week just on Katrina reporting.
Wow.
So the unverified media reports actually prevented humanitarian and aid and rescue efforts in those early days. So the media loop was that there were reports of widespread violence that were being spread with no mm-hmm. evidence of this whatsoever. Stations picked them up and repeated them ad nauseum. And these rumors were then also circulated among law enforcement and National Guard on the ground.
Wow.
It's a perfect soup, as you can mm-hmm. imagine. So rather than focus on evacuation or providing aid, since people had no food or water, trash was overflowing, toilets were backed up, people were dying from the heat and just being covered with blankets. These responders were tasked with crowd control and security, and they became focused on looting yeah. rather than aid.
Yeah.
So the media is reporting out these rumors. The people on the ground are hearing them as facts and also spreading them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're responding to a perceived and wholly false narrative that there is a crime problem that's out of control.
Yeah.
Even the people in the Superdome who had radios are hearing these reports and fearing for their own safety inside
yeah.
the Superdome.
For sure.
So one former resident, Shelton Alexander, and he's featured a lot in both documentaries mm. because he took a lot of footage. He was a poet and he happened to be like recording mm-hmm. during the time of Katrina. And he thought, well, this is a good time to have yeah. my camera on. So he has lots of video and he's talking to a lady at the bathroom about a report that a girl was mm-hmm. raped in the bathroom. None of this was
Didn't
true.
Mm.
None of this was true. People were taking stuff from stores because they were desperate.
Yeah.
There's also a lots of video of this because the media just stands out there and takes video mm-hmm. of people going into the stores and taking stuff. Yeah. They had limited food and water at the Superdome. And as more people are getting rescued and sent there, they're starting to run out of water.
Mm-hmm.
The media outlets reporting the violence. What these videos actually show, no violence was yeah. caught on camera, by mm-hmm. the way, not thousands of hours of footage and not a single instance of violence caught on camera. But these people were desperate, you know, so soaring temps, you've got sick people. Mm-hmm. Everyone's basically just sitting around waiting for buses mm-hmm. that were supposed to come that never came.
I mean, it's kind of absurd too. Like you're in the middle of a hurricane, you're chest deep in water and you're, you know, thinking people are like going in and stealing TVs and stuff like,
right.
no, they're trying, you're trying to survive.
Exactly.
Like you're trying to live to see tomorrow.
Yeah. So again, you have video of people taking food and supplies from stores, but they're also sharing it with other people at the Superdome and Convention Center. Again, this is on video. Mm-hmm. People were cooking up food and sharing it with one another. There was a collective effort to help rather than harm one mm-hmm. another. And the racial framing of this narrative was obvious to many people who watched the news during this time. Mm. Even some good reporters mentioned it. In one of the documentaries, it's actually Soledad O'Brien, who was working for CNN. She admitted that she was initially a part of the problem because they were reporting the crime, not having any evidence of it. They were just reporting what they were being told about the violence. But during her segment, they show the now very famous two still shots with captions. One picture showed a black man in flood water up to his chest with a garbage bag of stuff. And the other showed two white people also in water. And they had the same caption at the beginning. It says, a black man or two people wade through chest deep water. With the photo with the black man, it says looting a grocery store, wades through chest deep water to loot a grocery store. And in the other photo, it says they wade through chest deep water, finding bread and soda in a grocery store. Like, that is the most obvious framing that we're talking about here. So, you know, one of the judgments during this time was also about what people were taking from stores. So the cops would roll up and point this, like, this is on camera, would roll up and point guns, for example, at a black man coming out of a store with a handful of clothes. But everything was destroyed. They were soaked. They had been in water for days at this point. Of course, they're going to take clothes. So some people who had been stranded previously and were making their way to the Superdome had been walking in these chest-high floodwaters with sewage and dead bodies and other waste. Some people lost their shoes. Others had been injured while walking in the water. One resident said that one of his family members accidentally, because you can't see in the water, kicked a stop sign. He didn't see it while they were walking, and he ends up later dying from the infected cut because there was no medical care. So other people said there's alligators, snakes in the water because it's New Orleans.
Yeah, for sure.
So people were terrified.
I mean, in that situation, I would be more scared of like the nasty things in the water than a snake or an alligator.
And all of the aerial footage, you can see all the stuff floating in the water. I mean, again, it was chest high in most places.
And what about the mayor? He was super helpful, handy-dandy helpful howl in this situation,
Yeah. The mayor, the governor, and the president all made this, you know, narrative worse. They kept talking about the crime problem, the apocalyptic scene. The FEMA director, Michael Brown, or Brownie, as the president called him, because he said, you're doing a good job, Brownie, which was 100% false at the time. He was forced to resign only 2 weeks into this. He famously called victims people who were victims, thugs on television. And we could do a whole episode on this guy too, since the only qualifications he had prior to this was as the director of an International Arabian Horse Association. And the people from this organization told reporters that he resigned under pressure. They were surprised he got the job as the director of FEMA because he wasn't very good at the horse job.
The horse job. Sounds like he was the director of the Alliance for Horses. But at least he had some directorial experience and wasn't just a TV host.
True. True. Okay, yeah. Brown, real piece of work, that guy.
Sounds like it.
Yeah. So the FEMA person on the ground during New Orleans, which wasn't him, he was the director was staged in Baton Rouge. He didn't go down there. So this person on the ground was emailing him constantly about the dire conditions, imploring him to act, said, and this is too good not to share. One of his people was scolded in an email about bugging Brown because he needed more time to eat dinner.
Don't interrupt my dinner.
He said, his person, you know, said, the restaurants were back in Baton Rouge and it was taking them longer to get service and longer to get to dinner and they need more than 20 or 30 minutes to eat. And so this guy responded, he was like, well, that's great. I just ate an MRE. I took a dump outside and I'm going to try tonight to make sure that the pebbles from the ground don't stick me in the back too much when I try to get a couple of hours sleep in the parking garage. Like the tone deafness of like just not caring about the dire conditions on the ground.
Don't bother me with your dying people. The line at the restaurant is too long.
So FEMA was not in a position to respond to a disaster, which is ironic given their name as the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Disaster relief is kind of what they're known for. They said, you know, we don't do that. We come in after disasters to assist when local officials can't do it themselves, when they get stuck, basically. So eventually they get Army General Honoré, and this guy is amazing. Mm-hmm. He is featured heavily in both documentaries, and he is just a character. So they get him to command the relief task force, and he understood immediately this is an evacuation problem, not a crime problem. Yeah. This mission is humanitarian, and the main problem is that we need to get people out.
Yeah.
But the politicians and the media were too focused on the fake crime problem. And at one point, the governor says in a press conference that the soldiers have guns and will shoot and kill looters. Mm. And General Honoré is, as I said, very colorful. And mm-hmm. his language mm-hmm. is also
crazy. Nice.
He curses throughout both documentaries.
Nice.
But he told the governor that you cannot tell my soldiers to shoot and kill their own people. Like, what are you thinking?
Yeah.
Like, this is an evacuation situation. Like, I'm mm-hmm. on the ground here. I can tell you there's no crime problem.
Mm-hmm.
So the National Guard coming in, though, from out of town to relieve the others are also hearing rumors of snipers and shooters and coming in with that mindset. So they had weapons up and pointed at people at the convention center who had no food or water for 3 days because there was nothing at the convention mm-hmm. center at, like there was at the Superdome.
Mm.
So it was 2 to 3 days before anyone at the convention center got water.
Oh, my gosh.
The situation was worse.
Yeah.
MREs had been provided to the Superdome, but eventually there's 15,000 to 20,000 people also at the convention center.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the 30,000 eventually that ends up in Superdome.
Wow. You're
talking about 50,000 people, basically. Mm-hmm. So the sniper rumors turned out to be, according to Honoré, people who were still trapped who were waiting for rescues. And it was an isolated incident of someone basically shooting into the sky to let the helicopter know that they were mm-hmm. there. They were still waiting to be rescued.
Mm-hmm.
When asked in the documentary, the police chief is asked why he used the word sniper when that was not the case. And you know, he also got on TV multiple times and said snipers were shooting at law enforcement. He admits he probably should not have done that.
Probably not.
And that he was simply reporting what he was told. And that sniper versus mm-hmm. somebody shooting into the air is just like jargon, different jargon.
Yeah. No.
So General Honoré recalls having to tell soldiers to stop waving their guns at people, reminding them that they were there to help and not intimidate. So there's footage of him going around mm-hmm. saying, get your GD weapons down. He's mm-hmm. like screaming at them mm-hmm. to get their weapons down. And he's, you know, Army and yeah. they're National yeah. Guard. So he's like, mm-hmm. I'm the person in charge here. So there was just so much misinformation that contributed to the larger tragedy, and we haven't even scratched the surface.
Wow. So people were eventually evacuated, though.
Yes, but it took almost a week. Buses were on the way on Thursday, which is 4 days after this happened. And then they actually stopped outside of the city because they also heard the violence rumors and they wouldn't enter. So the bus drivers would not drive the buses into the city to evacuate people. That narrative delayed rescue and evacuation efforts, but also was used to justify violence by the police. Mm. There are two murders by police discussed in the documentaries, but they don't even cover the Danziger Bridge shootings, which actually the anniversary of those is today. It was exactly wow. 20 years ago because it was on September 4th.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where a group of officers just rolled up to a group of people on the bridge walking and started firing. They killed a 17-year-old boy and a man with developmental disabilities who had 5 bullets in his back.
Mm-hmm.
They then also tried to cover it up by saying they had weapons and were firing, but there were too many witnesses and evidence to prove that was false. Ultimately, there were 5 officers that served prison time for this.
Yeah, there's a box on this in my ethics textbook. But one of the guys, like they planted a gun too. One of the guys like goes home and gets a gun from his house the next day and brings it back and says he found it the next day while he was searching the scene.
Yes, and there yeah. was someone who told him to do that, and they mm-hmm. also tried to hold that person accountable, mm-hmm. but he gave evidence mm-hmm. about that. So,
mm. And what about vigilantes? This seems like a ripe situation for some vigilantism.
Oh, yeah, you know it. So there was one neighborhood specifically called Algiers Point where white vigilantes were using the looting excuse to shoot black evacuees, mm. some of whom were just trying to get there to the dock because they heard there were ferries evacuating people. One man was convicted for a hate crime, but it's estimated that five people ended up dying this way. So, and one of these guys on camera just says, "We shoot anything that moves," and they're laughing, drinking beer, smoking. And he said, "It's like pheasant hunting season in South Dakota."
Oh my gosh. And so this was like footage happening at the time. This is not them being interviewed.
No, this was footage happening at the time. Mm-hmm. So, and again, we haven't, you know, even really scratch the surface here. But, you know, just before I move on, I did want to mention, in terms of how many people died in the Superdome, it was only about 10. So if you think about the tens of thousands of people in there, most of those were natural causes due to heat, age, you know, sickness, et cetera. They do believe there was one suicide, shocking, like in those conditions, and one drug overdose. No one was murdered. There was no like theft. There was nothing to steal from each other. It's just ridiculous. So the last thing I'm going to just briefly touch on is migration and internal displacement. Two generations were lost in the storm, and many of the low-lying neighborhoods that had the worst flooding were predominantly Black. Lots of these families owned their homes, which had been passed down from generations. They owned the land, and to lose it was more devastating because the poor cannot afford to rebuild in the same way that middle-class families can and did. A study using government data to observe the movements of residents from 2006 to 2019 found that white residents were the first to come back in large numbers, and the Black residents had a more staggered return. And when it came to the pace of return, Elizabeth Fussell, who's a sociologist and demographer studying this, said that race and flood depth were by far the most important indicators. There was also widespread gentrification in Black neighborhoods as well-meaning white people moved to New Orleans to help rebuild and vitalize the city, they bought up some of the houses, though, and decreased occupancy because these were two people could live in this house, and then it became one house and rent increases, et cetera, all the problems with gentrification. So a year after the storm, 56% of displaced residents had returned to New Orleans. By 2019, it was 85%. So that's pretty significant. But some just stayed in Houston and Atlanta, which were the two cities where there were a lot of evacuees. There were programs established to help residents rebuild, and the city received $10 billion in federal funding for the Road Home Program. But not surprisingly, the way that insurance companies and banks lent money from the program was based on the pre-storm value of the house. So people in the more upscale neighborhoods like Lakeview received more money to rebuild their homes, even though the materials cost the same. So I haven't even touched on the Make It Right, or as we called them when I was there in 2008, the Brad Pitt homes, because he was the face of the nonprofit. These let first respond, they were trying to get first responders and educators, Black educators, to move back. And so they offered them these new carbon neutral, climate change friendly houses for almost nothing.
Oh my gosh, that's so nice. That's
so nice. That started to fail spectacularly when it rained because the floors came apart. There's at the end of the documentary, there's all the people who got these houses, they filed a lawsuit. Like they were so bad, they had to take out huge loans to fix these so-called free houses. And there's one person who's responsible for trying to get money to these people. But like one, you know, educator, she says on there that they love it there, they want to stay, but they had to take out $200,000 to pay for this free house.
Oh my goodness.
So, you know, like they uprooted themselves and moved back there, and this is what happens.
Wow.
Well,
got anything else?
We didn't even get into the toxic FEMA trailers or the educational system where they went through and fired over 5,000 Black educators, but we don't have time to talk about all that. So we're just going to wrap it up here.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll do another episode at some point in the future on this.
Yeah, there's some just so things. Much. Yeah. There's actually too much in one episode to discuss.
Well, then let's wrap it up with our Minute to Spin It, where we both give our takeaway from today's episode. So in just a minute, Tammy, what's your spin?
As community organizer Malik Rahim says in the documentary, the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina was entirely man-made. Systemic failure, political impotence, media distortions, and misinformation, all of these led to unnecessary deaths for those trapped in the storm surge. For the people who evacuated or were rescued to the Superdome and convention centers, there were tens of thousands of people who simply tried to survive and just waited patiently for help. There's video of all of these people sitting, waiting patiently. Nobody's got any, nobody had any food. They had no energy. It's not like they're going to get into fights. So General Honoré refers to this as the patience of the poor, because when you're poor, you don't have any, you're not free. You do not have choices. And so you learn how to wait. In hindsight, 20 years later, many of the people who contributed to the tragedy are able to recognize their part, but it did not have to happen this way.
Well said.
Ben, what's your spin?
Well, we need a little bacon and we need a little beans, but we survived a hurricane way down in New Orleans. So there are lots of good New Orleans songs that I could pick from. I particularly love The House of the Rising Sun, but I wasn't about to try to, to sing that one. But anyway, 1814 took a little trip. But I can't, I can't believe it's been 20 years, and we definitely needed a reminder of these lessons of Hurricane Katrina. And particularly, we also need to lament the fact that Kanye West, who once called out our leaders for being racist, is now a Nazi. George Bush did not care about black people.
We are a community-driven podcast sponsored by the Gandhi Center and produced by JMU Libraries. Check out our website, linked in show notes, to see how you can support our educational programming.